ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. A few years ago, a publisher rang to ask if I could write the history of all music in about 40,000 words. And I said yes, always up for a challenge. My guest on today's music show had a similar call, and he said yes too. But he was both more and less ambitious. Less ambitious because he restricted himself to writing about just 50 pieces. More ambitious because his book sets out to be a history of the world, a history of the world in 50 pieces, the classical music that shapes us. That's the full title. And the author is Tom Service, who's a presenter at BBC Radio 3, which is the Beeb's equivalent of ABC Classic. We'll talk to Tom in a moment. He speaks about as fast as this music is going, and we'll drag out of him as many of the big ideas as possible. But first, let's listen to the rest of Mozart's Overture to the Marriage of Figaro. It's the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted as if he had a train to catch by Riccardo Muti. The Overture to the Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Riccardo Muti. And it's the place to start, I think, a nice, bustling, busy overture to introduce Tom Service, BBC broadcaster, and in this case, the author of A History of the World in 50 Pieces, the classical music that shapes us. Welcome to the music show, Tom.
It's a great privilege to be here, Andy. Thank you for having me.
I I would like, and this may actually end up being the entire interview, I would like to talk about the title and to parse it pretty much one word at a time. So can we start with world, the history of the world?
Well, if I can bring some of it together, I mean, I think it's worth saying that one of the things I do in the introduction, or at least try to do in the introduction, is say how ludicrous both the project is and the title is. I think the only word that I can particularly definitely stand by is the indefinite article. This is a totally myopic, temporally wildly unbalanced, Northern Hemisphere focused that reveals far too much of its author's prejudices and tastes and those sorts of things. That's not the only project, though. I have attempted to get past as many of those things as possible, but yeah, there are clear limitations that come entirely from me here in defining what the world is. I mean, look, I at least attempt to begin with something reflecting the world as a geological, indeed cosmic entity. The wonderful recordings of Jez Riley French, who's recorded the sound of the rotation of the Earth by putting hydrophones and geophones through fumaroles in Iceland. So I think a sort of sense, I hope, that at least we start with the idea of how futile not only the whole enterprise is, but our whole lives are, and in the sense of their connections with those deepest songs of all. I suppose what the pitch of the book is, though, is to say that everything that happens in the book from that point is that we are connected, not only to those huge songs of the earth, but to each other through the communities of listeners and, you know, geographical spread and everything. We are together in this project. That's my hope, anyway.
Okay, well, that's world. What about classical music?
Yeah, I hate the word classical music. I think the big problem with classical music, as it's become defined, especially by Eurocentric culture, sort of as that's dispersed itself, not least colonially, all over the world, is that it's become so much an emblem of things that are better than. Typically, the whole industry of classical music, as it grew up in the 19th century and 20th century, and the recording industry is a big part of this too, was basically to turn itself into an aspirational lifestyle project, you know, a kind of extension of the bourgeois feeling that by going to these temples of culture, you were not only, well, it's not really that you were bettering yourself, you were being seen to better yourself. Now, that's a manifest lie when it comes to what we know about the impacts of the classical music industry in every dimension, from architecture to instrument manufacture to canon formation to all those things that go on to make the industry. The only sense in which I stand by the idea of what quote-unquote classical music might be is in this sense. The pieces here are designed not to be things that, I mean, one version of what this book, I guess, could have been, or other books, you know, that have been written and will be written, let's say 50 songs, 50 events, 50 moments in time. The point about this is to say that the thing that connects classical cultures across the world, whether we're talking, you know, gamelan or Indian traditions, or whether we're talking about the way that classical music through orchestras, chamber music and opera and all that has extended itself, is that the music does not belong only to the moment of its creation, and it certainly doesn't belong to its creator. The potential is that these are pieces that can be shared and that they are remade and reinterpreted, and new meanings are created for them in new performances in every present tense, in every community that has that performs them, chooses to listen to them, chooses to engage with them at any distance of time or place from their creation. That, I think, is the principle of classical music cultures that I do at least stand by. And that's why in the title.
So it's a sort of repertoire.
Yes, a repertoire, but something that can be remade, something that can be shared as democratically as possible as those cultures allow. Yeah.
But I mean, that includes oral traditions as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, naturally, absolutely. And yeah, that's clearly one of the differences of what this book is, by focusing on the idea of classical cultures, which are not only orally transmitted, but can be transmitted through various kinds of notation. But yeah, Andy, you're completely right. The sense of oral traditions and sharedness, I mean, there is some of that in the book in the sense of the songs that we have, which feel like oral traditions. Some of them feel like oral traditions, but are in fact not. Happy Birthday, Mbube, things like that. But yes, all the things I've said could be said about folk music cultures too. Absolutely, 100%.
Two more words to go, Tom. I'll just remind our listeners that I'm speaking to Tom Service, who is the author of A History of the World in 50 Pieces, the classical music that shapes us. Shapes, present tense.
Absolutely. That's entirely the point. Because this music, whenever it's engaged with by whichever, you know, communities and cultures are playing, you started off playing The Marriage of Figaro continues to shape us. It's not something which is fixed in an aspect. That's absolutely fundamental to the approach I've taken here. I regard all of these pieces as being, as you know, of course, they're, I think it's, I want to try and give some fragmentary look into how and why these pieces were made, but that they are also, in a sense, histories of our future, in the sense of the way that, I don't know, a piece like Lili Boulanger's Du Fond de l'Abîme, let's say, is reinterpreted, and the resonances it continues to have for our world now and the world in the future. This music is an invitation for all of us to participate in it and to continue to shape our personal emotional worlds and the wider context and conversations we have about what culture means and what it can do in our lives.
And I suppose that it not only shapes us, but we shape it. I mean, certainly when somebody performs the overture to The Marriage of Figaro, you make all sorts of choices and there are no two performances that are identical. So we are shaping it as well as it is shaping us.
No, entirely. And that example of a performance culture which is largely unbroken since 1786 when the piece was new, clearly, absolutely, we're in a dialogue with it all the time. I mean, think about the difference between, okay, let's say that Riccardo Muti performance or something like what René Jacobs is doing with Concerto Köln. I mean, those sound worlds aren't only about what the thing sounds like, they're about what this stuff means. And that's, I mean, in thinking about The Marriage of Figaro, the story I'm trying to tell with that, remind us about, is how situated that music is in conversations about society, especially women's place in society, the relationship between aristocrats and servants, democracy and censorship, and indeed sexual violence. I mean, that's really what that piece is about. So one of, again, the problems of the way that classical music receives its canons is that something that The Marriage of Figaro becomes, oh yeah, we just go along to The Marriage of Figaro at Glyndebourne or in Sydney or wherever, and that's all marvellous and we have a lovely time. But if you think through what actually happens, That piece only got through the censors because De Ponte managed to get a banned play, a play that had been explicitly banned by the Emperor of Vienna. He managed to get it through the censors. In Mozart's music, you hear that radical act of empathy in the way he dramatizes everyone, from the Count to Cherubino. And at the very end, he seems to offer a kind of forgiveness, but I don't buy it, Andy. I think that piece is so much more, not only subversive, but actually, I think it's a really problematic piece in actually what it, the mirror it shows up to a society, which does not tie the bow together, but rather says, look, Cherubino is basically another count in training, another abuser in training. That's where we end up at the end of the opera. And this is, you know, one of the pieces that you go to and go, oh, isn't the Marriage of Figaro lovely? That's what I want to do with the things that are more familiar in this book. I want at least to attempt to show that there are other ways of thinking about them. And then with pieces which don't have the same continuity of performance culture, but in my view should, let's say, I don't know, the operas of Francesca Caccini, the vocal works of Barbara Strozzi, the sonatas of Isabella Leonarda, to say, look, there is a reason why those performance traditions are broken, but they should be reinstated. You know, to hear more of the music of Margaret Bonds, for example, or Yoko Ono, or all of the other composers who, or the, as you've slightly alluded to, the very few composers. I mean, there are only 50 of them, roughly, in the book.
Yes, in fact, some of them are not composers either, some of these pieces. That's my last word, by the way, pieces.
Oh, yes, good point. Yeah. My definition there is that, with all of the caveats sort of outlined, that they offer the possibility of reinterpretation, that they are in some way promises that are redeemed by cultures in the future. We think of classical music tradition as quote-unquote a notational tradition, or even another heavy quotes, literary tradition. You know, the notes are only ever part of what music is, of course. So, you know, classical music cultures are always oral traditions to one degree or another. Nonetheless, you know, of course, notation is a thing, but that's the point. You know, they are then shared through posterity, through the possibility of generations that the composers themselves could not imagine, and are then taken on by them. That's what a piece of music is. It's a promise, a musical promise to the future that's redeemed by communities of listeners, performers, and cultures in the future.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. That was a little of Francesca Caccini's opera, La Liberazione di Ruggiero, and it's one of the 50 pieces that form Tom Service's book, A History of the World in 50 Pieces, the classical music that shapes us. Tom, there's repertoire pieces here, there's canonical pieces, the St. Matthew Passion, Messiah, Wagner's Ring, Beethoven's Ninth, The Rite of Spring, The Lark Ascending, and you come right through to Kayasariaho's Innocence, which is arguably the most important opera of the 21st century so far anyway. But you also include the first book of madrigals by Maddalena Casulana, a choral work by Roque Jacinto de Chavarria, operas by Joseph Bologna and Louise Bertin. The fact that it's a history of the world allows you to do that, whereas if it had been a history of music, it would have been slightly trickier.
No, I disagree, because the two things are fundamentally connected, Andy. I take the point to the extent that, yes, a history of the way music has been told might not include some of these pieces. And clearly, I wanted to show that just as important in late 18th century life, if not actually more important in late 18th century European and, in fact, world history terms, is the life of Joseph Boulogne. More important or as important as Wolfgang Amadei Mozart, for sure. And were a project given to me and a publisher in the unlikely event anyone was coming to say write a history of music, I would absolutely would want to include those voices and all the names you just described. The Roque Jacinto de Chavarria is an astounding piece that in 6 minutes shows what a mixed heritage composer, Bolivian, was doing in order to return the colonial gaze about repertoires that the Jesuits had brought over in their sort of soft power colonization of South America. That to me is an astounding and important story that we can actually hear the results of in music, as the Spanish say to the quote-unquote Indians around Jesus' crib, oh, you shouldn't be here. And they say to the Spanish, but we are sons of Adams too. Everyone has a right to be here. Let's all be together. I mean, that to me is an absolutely thrilling example of how music, how a piece of music can distill and tell a story which otherwise would not be told.
So it places music in the world, doesn't it? Maybe we should pause and listen to this music before we proceed. You're a BBC presenter. I'm going to get you to introduce this.
Yeah, well, here is Roque Jacinto de Chavarrillo's Fuera, Fuera, Haganes Dugar, the players of Florilegium, the Araquenda Bolivia Choir, a Bolivian choir led by Ashley Sonman. Just listen to this.
Como su gloria descansó, sosiego y
Fuera Fuera Haganles Lugar. Roque Jacinto de Chavarria, Ashley Solomon leading the players of Florilegium, and the singers too, and really importantly, the singers of the Arakenda Bolivia Choir, the Bolivian choir that Ashley Solomon made and led there.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National, co-presented today by Tom Serviss and me, Andrew Ford. We're talking about Tom's book, History of the World in 50 Pieces, the classical music that shapes us. So let's talk about some of the specific choices that you made here, because there's lots of provocations. One sort of very simple provocation, which you don't actually spell out, but it's there anyway, is to put two pieces from 1957 alongside each other. Stockhausen's Gruppen and Bernstein's West Side Story. That's a lovely juxtaposition. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I think there are a few moments in the book where this kind of duopoly kind of happens. I'm thinking of Lili Boulanger and Igor Stravinsky and The Messiah and the Matthew Passion. But yeah, no, this one, well, I mean, okay, that coincidence of time is one thing. But I think they both propose and give us completely different definitions about what modernity might be, what it sounds like, and what actually are the forces that drive it underneath. Gruppen, in some, I suppose, probably quite narrowly musicological settings, has been often talked about through, of course, the astounding thing that it's doing with form and structure and, frankly, sheer visceral experience, you know, the harmony, the way that the whole thing is made, the way the sounds swirl around you still sound new. That's the point. But the reason for that is because of Stockhausen's personal biography, you know, the things that happened to him and his family during the war, his father the Nazi, his mother killed by the Nazis as mentally not fit for society, his own experience as a very young soldier. He wanted to build a new world, and a world that would have as little as possible to do with any of the romantic, subjectivist indulgences of the language that had brought the entire world to the catastrophe of the Second World War. So on one hand, I want to be able to show that the supposed abstraction of that music actually has a deep psychological and emotional necessity behind it, and tells us something really important about what that post-war generation are doing as human beings as well as composers. So that's one idea of what the new world can be, and it's completely thrilling. I mean, I think that's the point, Andy. You know, Gruppen will always sound new, you know?
Yeah, and in fact, it's such a bold statement with the three orchestras, as you said, the sounds swirling around, being thrown from one orchestra to another.
Yeah.
It's quite romantic in its way.
Definitely, and there is, in fact, one key piece of information about that is that, the structure of the piece, the way it unfurls in time, is really driven by what Stockhausen was looking at, and the silhouette of those beautiful mountains. He was looking at Passbells in Switzerland that are mapped on to the structure of the piece. So in that sense, yeah, you're right. I mean, it is a kind of, it's another turn on that old saw of landscape-inspired romantic German music, in a sense. Although you would want to say it's still the big bands of an alien civilization. You know, it's got that energy to it as well. I think then the contrast with Bernstein and West Side Story partly what that piece sounds like, the things that Bernstein's doing with the motto of the tritone, you know, the sustaining idea for that entire score pretty well, but also just the context in which the piece was made. Lincoln Center was built in New York, that absolutely, you know, neo-temple to the uptown New York and its sophisticated cultures, ballet and opera and concert music. It was a Puerto Rican slum that was leveled in order to give way to make those buildings happen. And what are Bernstein and his collaborators doing at the very same time in the 1950s when that's being built? They're telling a story of precisely those Puerto Rican communities who used to live in and around that area. So, again, what the piece is in terms of its hybrid identity between opera, music, theatre, all of those things, but also another kind of modernity, but a modernity that comes at the clear cost of those people who were effectively cleared to make way for, you know, temples of culture, of which Bernstein and Sondheim and Robbins would then lead, and they're telling their stories. So it's a wonderful and problematic gloss on what that modernity means and what these cultural institutions do in all our cities and their place, and sometimes the cost that they bring as well.
Yes, we have an opera house in Sydney built on Bennelong Point, which was the site of Aboriginal corroborees.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I suppose I want to do, I want to go against the idea that of itself any of this music might be good for us or make us better. I absolutely want people to listen to these pieces or to engage with them as vividly as possible and then to get cross with me and find other answers, for sure. But it's important to acknowledge what the power structures and the literal power of classical music and its cultures has done and is doing to the world. And mind you, I would say the same things. I mean, one of the other things I want to try and draw out in the book here is our importance as listeners. For those of us who are, I have to say, merely listeners, that's the opposite of what I mean. We're all involved in this project. And right now, in our world, often our listening is being decided for us, not here on The Music Show, where you are doing more to answer the algorithms every week in how your show is made. But in general, so much of our listening across the world at the moment is being decided to give us more of the same stuff that unseen commercial human-made forces want us to like. So I think I want, one of the other things I hope this election proves is that it would be, I guess not theoretically impossible, but it would be unlikely that an algorithm would come out with this selection of pieces. And I hope that's an invitation to people as well, I hope.
It's The Music Show on ABC Radio National, nobly resisting the algorithm. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm talking today to Tom Service about his book, History of the World in 50 Pieces. Now, interestingly, between Roque Jacinto de Chavarria's piece that we heard earlier and Pachelbel's famous canon is the C major scale. In what sense is this a piece?
I think it's definitely a piece in terms of the way it's written down in a million piano manuals all over the world, and it might be the first piece of notation that many piano players of any generation see and play from beginning to end. The reason that's there is because of the stories that this theoretically humble building block of much Western-inspired music, there are many stories to tell there about how we got to a place of equal temperament, what the semitones are, Pythagorean commas, and the fascinating psychoacoustics of the way pianos and sequences are tuned at the moment.
You could, I suppose, have had John Cage's 4 minutes 33 seconds, but you went instead for Yoko Ono's cut piece.
Yeah.
I mean, at least 4 minutes 33 seconds invites you to listen. Could you explain why cut piece is in the book?
Well, cut piece is in the book because of what it says about the place of our bodies in the listening experience, and because of the questions it asks us all about our responsibilities to one another. I mean, the piece does have it has more sound in it than many performances of 4:33, because there are environmental sounds of wherever it's done. There are the sounds of the scissors that are used as at Yoko Ono's request, or whoever's performing it, to have parts of their clothing cut away. And in that moment, you know, the relationship between audience and performer, the way that piece has been received, the shock of how it was heard in Japan, the voyeuristic thrill that some audiences took when Yoko Ono then performed it, or rather the audience performed it to her in the 1960s in New York, that it reveals so much about what these collaborative concert hall cultures are all about. And there is a version of the piece which has currently never been realised, which is that every member of the audience is invited to cut their own clothing away from each other. I mean, that would be a radical diffusion of that idea. But that's the reason. I also wanted to make, I mean, 433 is subliminally in the book, at least in the chapter about Pauline Oliveros and deep listening. So, yeah, I don't want to say that Cage is totally absent, because I think that the other, really, another of the themes here is who we all are as listening bodies. We aren't just, you know, ears on stalks. Our whole beings are involved in the musical experience. Not only our hearing apparatus, however capable it may be, our bodies are designed to receive these physical things of pressure waves, sound waves, and to interpret them. Our bodies are always involved, and not only that, the way that bodies move, the way that we all move, our insides move when we're reacting to the music, that's all part of it too. So for me, Cut Piece is a very important version of that story. And yes, a provocation for us to think about what it all means when we're together in a concert hall.
Well, yeah, and it's obviously a good example of audience participation. It's almost like sort of the avant-garde equivalent of community singing.
Yes.
Speaking of community singing, we have Happy Birthday to You.
Yes, the thing I love about that story is that it's a piece which feels like it, you know, belongs to everyone, is absolutely a part of the world's collective commons and oral culture to which we are all, that connects us all. It might be the only bit of communal singing that families or communities do every year, and it is the most sung song in the world, but we know who made it, you know, Mildred and Patty Hill in 1893 in Kentucky, when they changed the words of Good Morning to You to Happy Birthday to You when they were staying at a cabin in Kentucky. But then what happens is that becomes a story of musical ownership when Warner Chappell and publishers realise, oh, there's money to be made in them hills. And it meant that for most of the 20th century, especially in America, but if you were a restaurant or if you were a concert hall and you wanted to play Happy Birthday, you couldn't without paying rights, without paying a fee to Warner Chappell. So there's a whole sort of repertoire of sub-Happy Birthday songs, which aren't Happy Birthday, but which are designed to sell. It's absolutely hilarious. But it was only in the mid-20-teens that a Canadian filmmaker was making a film about Happy Birthday and took Warner Chapel or took the whole idea to court, and finally, yes, it is now okay, Andy. Next time you're singing Happy Birthday, you don't have to pay anyone anything.
Thank this is God
a,
for that.
A public service announcement that we can all enjoy.
But it's nice that it should have started by them changing the words of an existing song.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. And also, the interesting thing is there, I mean, they were pioneering educationalists for the kindergarten idea, you know, the idea of children learning through doing. So, again, there's a sense there where that tune and what it means was made as a place, as you've alluded to, of musical participation. That's what it's for. It's a visionary piece, much maligned as a piece of music, too. Think about that suspension. Come on, over our names. It's beautiful.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes. No, I was singing it only the other day to my daughter. So there you are.
Oh, congratulations. Congratulations.
Now, you mentioned Mbube by Solomon Linda, which might be better known to listeners as either Wimowe or The Lion Sleeps Tonight. On the subject of intellectual property, this is another great story.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing and troubling story, and all too typical. This tune or series of tunes and ideas is still arguably, or certainly has been, the most famous song that conjures up the idea of a continent in the world's listening, for anyone who isn't living in Africa. But the reason that's important is because this was made by Solomon Linda in Johannesburg in 1939, became incredibly successful. He never received any royalties despite selling 100,000 copies. Anyway, Forward Wind, the wonderful musician Pete Seeger, he heard a recording of this and assumed it was a folk tune. So, in fact, he and his band, the Weavers, thought it was a, you know, a South African folk tune, invented a name in order to claim copyright for it. Oh, 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 oh. Pete Seeger subsequently apologised and said that the royalties would go to Solomon Lindner and his family. But the thing is, that happened decades later, and clearly not enough work was done to understand that this doesn't belong. It was created by Solomon Lindner and his musicians. But that's just the start of the story. What then becomes The Lion Sleeps Tonight? I mean, talk about, you know, racialised caricatures of what starts off as a plea for Zulu independence. That's what the image of the lion sleeping and awaking is all about in the original. Instead of which, it becomes that caricature. In the 1960s, it reaches the top of the charts in the United States, and it keeps going. It's there in the 1980s in the United Kingdom, and of course it's on the Lion King soundtrack as well, so everybody has appropriated this song.
Near the village, the peaceful village, the lion sleeps tonight.
And then the story of what actually happens to Solomon Lindner's surviving family, his daughters, it's Ria Milan who absolutely wanted to do what he could for them. The whole thing becomes enmeshed in the politics of South Africa, absolutely the politics of race in South Africa, but not only there, all over the world. And the basic feeling that the people who made this music were never received the royalties which were their due, and then were told that they didn't even exist as creators. You'd like to say this is a sort of cautionary tale that woke up the world to similar stories around many other tunes that are being dispersed all over the world right now. I mean, look at what's happening with the politics and payments or otherwise of streaming services at the moment. But as ever, it's musicians, and in particular musicians from marginalised communities in the global sense, who are the victims of this process. It's still happening.
Well, of course, it was happening for hundreds and hundreds of years before this, before there was such a thing as copyright. I mean, because that's what an oral tradition is. I mean, somebody must have made up The Unquiet Grave, but we don't know who, and now it's just a folk song.
True, but I think the way that the Mbube story is clearly about white musicians and then, you know, rich corporations like Disney profiting wildly from precisely the copyright that they never extended or bothered to find out about the original creator. That's the point.
On today's music show, I'm talking to Tom Service about his book, History of the World in 50 Pieces. I'd like to mention just briefly The Lark Ascending, because I found that slightly surprising inclusion, because it's a sort of slight piece, mind you, so the Pachelbel canon, and yet you make some wonderfully interesting points about it.
Well, I just think that piece is one of those things in where I'm talking to you from the United Kingdom is taken for granted because of its popularity quite a lot of the time. But I just think what it is doing in sound and idea, you know, written around the First World War, it has become a lightning rod for so much feeling, the way that piece has been used. I mean, not least at, you know, moments that are the veils of our lives. Concert halls are one thing, but, you know, memorials are another, and all times of our lives where we feel we need that piece. And it's trying to understand the very specific images of transcendence that come from George Meredith's poem, but that Vaughan Williams isn't simply translating. You know, he's giving to us as an experience which, because of the thing that music does as physical, you know, pressure waves and things we feel, it takes us to those places. what it then has to say, partly through that connection through, you know, the history of the First World War, but as I say, the way it's been taken on, it gives us a timelessness, a sense of looking at, you know, whatever metaphor you like, earth, ground, life, death, whatever, and taking leave of it, because that's exactly what the solo violin does. And that is something that's there in the notation as well, you know, no bar lines, the way that the stratosphere that we're supposed to hear, the, you know, the air underneath the bow when the violin's playing that high, you hear as much of the sound as you do the actual note, you know. Vaughan Williams knew all that. That's absolutely what's supposed to be happening. So for me, it's an important piece actually because of the story it tells about how and why it still touches us so deeply.
Tasman Little playing Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending. Tom Service, let's finish with America, A Prophecy, which is a piece that I only discovered from your book has been recently added to, but the original version was striking enough.
Yeah.
Tell us the story, because here's another piece that turns out to have been a prophecy in a way.
The piece was made by Thomas Addis as a message for the millennium. I mean, commissioned as such by the New York Philharmonic, and it was first performed in 1999. But it sets the poems of the Chilam Balam, the Mayan prophecies, written towards what would be the end of their era of civilization, and the text of the conquistadores as well. So you hear that collision of times, you know, the visions of the end. The mezzo-soprano sings, they will come from the east, they will burn all your lands, they will come from the east, they will burn. And it's an image of then, you know, the conquistadors come in the choir, and then we're given various images of Ash feeling no pain. And in the final new part that Thomas Addis has recently added, there's even more of a kind of extension to where that lament might end up cosmically. But look, for me, the title is borrowed from William Blake, but it's prophetic in the sense of telling something that's well-known, and about the only certainty there is, that empires rise and empires fall. And that will, perhaps it is even happening as we're speaking, Andy, in various different dimensions across the world. The thing I think that's stunning about it is the way that Thomas Addis makes that idea of different kinds of time colliding with one another and exploding. I mean, that's what's happening in the textures of the orchestration and the relationship between the choir and the soloist. So these things are given to us as I hope, you know, in a sense, all the things in this book are, they are given to us as embodied experience, which again, we can share and keep interpreting. I also do feel that in that sense, that all of these pieces can become our present tenses in how we all engage with them, listen to them, play them, whatever we want to do with them. They are all, in that sense, prophetic. You know, they will all continue to be with us, in heard in new ways, imagined in new ways, things that we can't probably conceive, but they will still be there.
Yes, and it's also a good example of our shaping music, because the piece had its premiere not that long before 9/11, and then the idea of these forces coming from the east and the burning and the ashes meant that the music itself really couldn't be played for quite a long time.
It was a very... it was a piece which was not performed in America for many years. I was there in 2009 in Los Angeles when Thomas Addis conducted it there. And funny enough, that was a time when Los Angeles was burning. It was a huge forest fire. So there was this eerie sense of Thomas Addis wanting to bring in that piece for one of the very few times that it had subsequently been done in America, and there being this feeling of apocalypse all around. It was there was that sense of prophecy occurring.
Well, on that prophetic note, I think maybe we have to wind up. But it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for giving us your time on The Music Show. And thank you for writing this book.
And it's a great, great pleasure. Thank you.
This is how Thomas Addis's America, A Prophecy used to finish the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and Chorus and the mezzo-soprano Susan Bickley. My guest was Tom Service, and his book is called A History of the World in 50 Pieces. It's published by BBC Books. And the music show is produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham. Technical production this week from Tegan Nichols. The show's made on Gadigal, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung country. And coming up, we've got a great violinist who came out of a Venetian orphanage and became a favourite of Vivaldi's. And a wonderful new album, often quite a funny album, from Kate Miller-Heitke, and also a new and fantastically weird album from Grace Cummings.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.